silence after that. O God of boundless mercy and of justice rolling down like waters, you have given us yet another gift, this day, this place, these faithful people, your word. Challenge us where we need to be confronted. Renew us when we weary of well-doing. Comfort us with your embracing love. Deliver us into your mighty peace. Most everybody's on this side of the room here. I'm going to turn around and I maybe have to shift again here. But has everybody got a Bible? Some up here, some over here. We were last time we were doing Genesis 16 and 21. And I see some familiar faces, so I think I'm just going to plunge in here, and we'll come back to the texts throughout. And if you haven't read these stories, I think you will have read them by the time we're done today. People, last time I invited you to ask questions about the stories as well as to produce some of your own interpretations and to think about how where you're coming from may have influenced your interpretation in some way. And today maybe we can address some of the questions, especially, for example, some of the questions that came up were why does Sarai blame Abram for the problems in the household with Hagar? Why does God tell Hagar to go back to the house of her mistress and the afflicting hands of her mistress? Does God use Hagar? What are Hagar's feelings? Why is it Abraham's fault? Why didn't God provide a child earlier? Is the angel really comforting to Hagar? Is that promise comforting? And other questions that came up. And what I'd like to do is take the liberty of presenting you with some ideas that I've come across in my own study of different interpretations of the story. From a variety of points of view, we can stop along the way to talk about what we think of these other interpretations. And we'll see how far we get in 1 hour. And I think it doesn't matter if we're not finished, because as I said last time, interpretation has done its work when it has opened the eyes and the ears. And that's a continual lifelong process, isn't it, of that opening. One of the people who's been very interesting and I think brought the Hagar and Sarah story to the attention of a lot of people is Phyllis Tribble, who is an Old Testament professor at Union Seminary in New York. She operates out of within a Christian context. She's not operating out of a Jewish context. She is a feminist, an early variety of feminist. She is also a literary critic of a kind that in my trade we call new criticism. And new criticism is really, by now, old criticism. It's a style that grew up after World War II. You take a text and you analyze it in great detail as to the structures of its sentences and the ordering of words in order to bring out meanings in the text. And one of the things that new criticism did not do, deliberately excluded, was to consider history in the context of texts. They just bracket all that and just look at the text. And there's a lot of advantage in that, but at some point, you know, you need to look at what's around it, what produced it, what implications it has for you, and so on. But that's the kind of criticism she does. She's a linguist. She knows Greek and she knows Hebrew particularly well, so she calls attention to words a lot. And I've written the name of her book on this board up here. Tax of Terror, this is available in the bookstore. So it's a slim volume with about 5 essays on different texts about women, terrifying moments that she's chosen to write about in their lives. And Hagar and Sarah is the first of these stories in her book. Excuse me. She wrote an earlier book. Do you know her work? Does anyone know her other book? It's longer and different, slightly different orientation. God and the Rhetoric of Sexuality, have you heard of this book? This also ought to be in the bookstore. If it's not there, it's just probably out of stock. God and the Rhetoric of Sexuality is a book that has a number of chapters on the creation and fall accounts. And it's very interesting in bringing out new interpretations of those accounts. She also has a lovely chapter in there on the Book of Ruth. There's another on the Song of Songs. And that, in many ways, is a very affirmative book. Text of Terror deliberately focuses on terrifying moments in women's lives in the Bible and reflects on what their meaning is for us today. One of the things that Tribble does as a literary critic with these two stories, Genesis 16 and 21, is to analyze the plot. So if you have any memories of high school, you'll just kind of look familiar somewhere. I'm going to erase a little bit of this here. Genesis 16, she says, has a plot that starts in bondage. Then Hagar flees, flight or escape, and it ends back in bondage again. That's Genesis 16. Genesis 21, she sees as starting in bondage, Hagar's back home. She doesn't flee, she's expelled. Expulsion, exile with what? Bread and water. For a very brief time in the desert, clearly she's on her way toward death. And then the story doesn't end with her death, but Tribble says that this story points toward homelessness. Now, these two analyses of the plot, one of them sort of goes outward, the other is a circle, are both, she says, plots of bondage and victimage. And you'll notice that I want to tell you what she says, but I want to also be critical of it, so I'm going to kind of step back from it from time to time in her theory. These two plots both focus on Hagar, not Sarah, not Abraham. That is a choice of focus. And you know yourself, when you focus a camera, you focus on something and you're excluding other things. And there's value in that, right? You can really see that alpine, you know, flower or that marmot or whatever it is. But then you can't see the other things around it so much. She's focusing on Hagar. She's also focusing on Hagar as a victim. These are victim plots. Right? Other people look at Hagar in some different ways. Secondly, she looks at language in the text. And here's where we can look back at our text. I have the King James here for old time's sake. You'll have something else, but they'll be similar. This is the kind of thing she does with language, and I find this useful because it gets more out of the text for me. You know, there's not much here. There's not too many words on the page, really, and the more you can get out of what's there, the better off you are. And knowing something about the literary techniques of the biblical writers and editors who put this story together in its present form helps us to understand their intention. And that's where I think literary criticism can help us study the Bible. Doesn't mean, as my students sometimes, you know, jump to conclusions, oh, that means the Bible's just a fiction, just because you're treating it like a short story. That's not the point. You know, the Bible is testimony, and it is formed in particular ways to get the testimony across, and not any other testimony. And so these stories are very deliberately written. We tend to think, as modern chauvinists, that, you know, the ancient writers were not as good as our writers. There's a progress. No way. These are very ancient texts, but they are extremely sophisticated. And these writers are very clever. They have a wonderful sense of humor, of irony, of playing around with language. They're very playful with words. There are a lot of puns in the Hebrew, which you know if you studied Hebrew. This is not something we're taught. And many of our modern translations, I was just looking at one at the American Bible Society the other day that they'll be bringing out shortly. They lose all the literary qualities of the text. And when you lose that, you don't just lose beauty, you lose meaning as well. Not that the King James is the best version, but it's what I have in front of me, and I can read it in this light. This is the main point. Now Sarai, Abram's wife, bare him no children. Right away, the storyteller is putting out an epithet, a name for her, identifying her. Her main point of identity is that she's Abram's wife. And she had a handmaid, an Egyptian whose name was Hagar. Notice that the narrator names this person in two ways, both by ethnic identification, she's an Egyptian, and by personal name, okay? And then by role, handmaid. And Sarai said unto Abraham, behold now, what kind of language is that? Wife to husband. Behold now.
You better listen.
Give me your attention.
Okay. Behold is a word in this story that turns up again. Behold now, the Lord hath restrained me from bearing. How do we know that? Sarah says so. Does the narrator say so? No. So there's a discrepancy right at the beginning of the story. Why would she say that? The narrator didn't tell us that the Lord is punishing her for some reason, or that the Lord is deliberately waiting and testing their faith. It does not say that. And so we can conclude a number of things, but I think the point of writing it kind of ambiguously that way, is Sarah right, or is that just her interpretation? I think the point of that is to invite us to ponder, why would she have to say this? And it might say something about Sarah's lack of faith. It might say something about her buying into this idea that just because she has no children, the Lord is, you know, some way punishing her. Maybe if that's not the reason. Or it might say something about her kind of defensiveness and feeling of guilt that she has no child. At any rate, we wonder about that. It may be, and then she says, I pray thee, go in unto my maid. Now this is command language, so it fits with the behold now. It may be that I may obtain children by her. Notice she says, I may obtain children by her. Now legally they're going to belong to the father.
Excuse me, what?
Legally they're going to belong to the father. The father has absolute control of the children in the patriarchal system of the biblical society. But the woman has influence and power in the family through her children. And so she says, I may obtain children by her. Now someone has said, this group or the other group, that this plan boomerangs. And the boomerangs are ironic things, right? And the writers bring out the ironies. The end of this story, we have not Sarah built up through children, but Hagar bare Abram a son, and Abram called his son's name, which Hagar bare, Ishmael. There's two reminders right there that Hagar bore the son, and Abram was 86 when Hagar bare Ishmael to Abram. Now, modern translations will take out some of the repetition. Clean up the text. You know? When you take out the repetition, you take out the emphasis. The emphasis here is on Hagar bearing a son to Abram, and it's definitely not to build up Sarah. So her plan had boomeranged by the end of this episode. Just a couple other points about this type of analysis. And Abram hearkened to the voice of Sarai. It's significant that he doesn't say a word. He just does it. Oftentimes you get this type of reaction when God says something to someone and then he does, you know, God says to Abraham and Abraham goes. Here we have the woman in that position and the man says nothing. And then suddenly, and then in verse 3, we have reminders of the relationships in the family that are beginning to be confused by this plan. And Sarai, Abram's wife, the narrator reminds us, that's who she is, took Hagar, her maid, the Egyptian, that's who she is, after Abram had dwelt 10 years in the land of Canaan, and gave her to her husband, Abram, emphasizing the kind of perversity of this. This is from a later perspective when Israel was no longer practicing polygamy, perhaps, or at least didn't approve of it quite in the same way. Gave this woman to Abram to be his wife. It's contradictory, it's kind of nonsensical the way it's said here, but that's part of the nonsense is what it's trying to bring out. And he went into unto Hagar and she conceived. So, and again, he acts, you know, according to plan. And now we have suddenly in verse 4, for the first time, Hagar as the subject of a verb. And you might think, what, so what? Well, it matters a lot in life if you are the subject of an action or the object of it. Most of us would prefer to be subjects of our actions. And Hagar is the object of all the actions and language up to this point in the story. She's silenced and made powerless. Suddenly, she conceived. And she sees as well as conceives. There's two conceptions here. One dawns in her brain, the other in her womb. She saw that she had conceived. Her mistress was despised in her eyes. Again, that idea of seeing. And despised, some of translations have other words here. Do you?
Look with contempt on her mistress.
All right. Look with contempt on her mistress. Now, this sounds bad, but we're not quite sure what this means. But clearly, Hagar suddenly sees things differently than the hierarchical system of the family in which she's been placed has had it before. So that the relations get kind of reversed here. And the powerful wife of the powerful patriarch with all the herds and possessions and servants is suddenly despised by this foreigner, this slave. And Sarah has set this in motion. So it's deeply ironic, this whole process.
Excuse me, I was wondering, you said Hagar is looking with contempt upon Sarah?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
That's the way.
That's the order. Mm. Yeah. But then Sarai speaks, and now there is a dialogue between husband and wife, and this time he does speak. But she starts it, and it's often significant where a dialogue starts. Who speaks first? I mean, this is common sense, right? Who has the last word? Who doesn't speak? My wrong be upon thee. Another sort of imperious statement. My wrong be upon thee. I have given my maid into thy bosom, and when she saw that she had conceived, I was despised in her eyes. The Lord judge between me and thee. She's really angry. What happened? Now, the text doesn't tell us why she's blaming. There's a lot of different responses she could have given to this situation. But she blames Abraham and says, the Lord judge between me and thee. What do you think might have happened? This is now guessing, but the text doesn't quite tell us. But it does tell us her reaction.
She may be thinking this was a mistake and she shouldn't have given Hagar to Abram.
She doesn't say that, does she?
But it kind of looks like that might be what she's thinking.
It's all deflected on another person and how common that is in domestic dramas. Yes?
I think Sarah's whole identity within the patriarchal system was defined by the fact that she would bear children. That was how she was going to be a person in this setting. Mm-hmm. And that she had failed to be that made her lower her being a non-person. And then she went ahead and followed the rules of the patriarchal structure, which said, if you can't, then you should provide someone else to do that. And so she followed all the rules to be the good wife. And having followed all the rules of the patriarchal system, she winds up getting the shaft. And she said, this is not fair. And knowing that it's a patriarchal system, she goes to the patriarch and blames him. And that's why he gets blamed here.
Yeah, you just said a lot, didn't you? I mean, the system is the only place she can live, mentally maybe and physically, to be, you know, sustained there. And she uses its language, she uses its arguments, she performs the behavior required of her, and it doesn't make her happy, it doesn't serve her needs.
You're talking about Sarah?
Sarah, at this moment, yeah.
It looks like Hagar is also using the same system.
Maybe, it's clear she's being used, right, because she's the object of these actions. Maybe she is also using the same system, because it's only through the system that she can be built up.
Well, it looks like back in verse 2, when Sarah says, "It may be that I shall obtain children by her," she must already be thinking about the possible consequences, and probably true that Hagar might have had those same thoughts. So in that sense, they're both using this, both using the system, although each may be thinking they're going to come out on top.
And they both lose in different ways. Hagar's not going to be able to keep that child. Anybody watch Color Purple the other night? As soon as the woman gives birth to the baby, the man takes it out of her arms. She's just heartbroken. And he takes it out into a snowstorm. And that's the end of it. Yeah.
Well, it sort of reminds of the surrogate mother, is that what you call it, in our society? Mm-hmm. That doesn't seem to work. There's something that happens. The mother carries the child, that child becomes hers. Mm-hmm. And it just doesn't, that separation just doesn't want to take place.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's not working very well here either. Hagar thinks she should probably be the patriarch's wife.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's something about that we're not told. Like, he went in and was it a one-shot thing and she conceived, or was there a relationship that developed that would have been Sarah's primary relationship? Mm-hmm. We don't know that.
The word Abraham hearkened, that maybe could be read with a little emphasis here. Maybe he did have his eye on her. Maybe that was...
Maybe that's why he never said anything. He was thinking, well, that's what he wanted.
I don't want to make waves.
Good point. I mean, his response to her, let's look at that for a minute. He says, behold, he says now, he's the one that says behold. Thy maid is in thy hand. He kind of turns the tables. He says, I'm not going to solve this. Thy maid, he reminds her with that epithet that it's her servant, her possession, ultimately his, of course, but hers more immediately. Thy maid is in thy hand. Do to her as it pleaseth thee. Notice he doesn't say my wife. Now, earlier we were told that she was given him as his wife, but he just, through his language, is kind of handing her back. You know, to her old status, Hagar, to her old status, do to her as it pleaseth thee. This does not have to do with pleasure. This is the King's English here, too, I guess. And then, so Sarai deals hardly with her, and she fled from her face. Now, you could say that Abraham is very wise in not getting entangled in the jealousy of his co-wives. Or you could say he's simply doing what the law allows him to do. And that is, it is, you know, there is influence and power that the wife has over her own maid. It's appropriate for her to deal with him. It may be more dignified for her to take care of the problem than to hand it over to him, you know, passing the buck. And after all, she started it, so maybe it's morally appropriate for her to do something. And at this point, if you want to think of Abraham as a man of faith and, you know, and righteousness, as in the Jewish tradition, you know, he's way up here. You could think, well, he is giving Sarai an opportunity to redeem herself, because she's really kind of made a spectacle of herself here. To redeem herself by what? What could she have done to Hagar that would have been merciful? Or, you know, kindly.
It supported her.
Yeah.
It says she dealt harshly with her. She probably scolded her.
Maybe beat her.
Beat her, yeah.
Didn't Abraham have a concubine at that time? Couldn't she have been another wife?
Well, it says here she is his wife. So yeah. what he's doing here is giving Sarah the option of then demoting Hagar back into her slave position. But Sarah does not have the right to kick her out of the house. She deals with her so harshly, though, that Hagar leaves. Now, Hagar, you think, well, this must have really been bad. This story is getting worse. Because at an earlier point, when she's handed over to Abraham, You know, Hagar might have wanted to leave at that point. She doesn't, but she leaves it here. There are a variety of things, ways you could read this Abraham thing. A Jewish feminist, whom I may talk about later if I get to it, but since you raised this point, I'm going to put this up here. Esther Fuchs at the University of Arizona, who published a number of articles on, she's an Old Testament scholar and an Israeli. She has a whole argument about this story that it's set up to make Abraham look really good. And by suppressing his responses, she doesn't allow any evidence to leak out that maybe he was, you know, he was interested in this woman, Hagar, or that he liked the idea of polygamy and approved of it, or anything else like that. So the silencing of Abraham is not taking power away from him, but in fact helps to give power to him. That's her interpretation. And you came up with it, something like it, too. Okay. Hagar flees into the wilderness, and this flight is a very mixed bag, I think, this part of the story. The angel of the Lord appears to her. This could also be considered the Lord, a God appearing to her. Found her by a fountain in the water of water in the wilderness. Now that is a good place to be in the wilderness. And she is on her way to Shur. Remember my map the other day? Egypt was down here. Well, Shur is on the way to Egypt. So she is going home. She seems to know her way. And she has also found water in the wilderness. So she's resourceful and strong in a sense in this at this point. And he says to her, of course, the Lord generally speaks first, and addresses her with her name, as Sarai did not do. And Sarai and Abraham did not talk to Hagar before in this story. Now there is dialogue, and it is with God. So all of a sudden, Hagar, who had been silenced, suppressed, rejected, afflicted in the earlier part of the story, suddenly becomes an immediate object of God's care and concern and language. And God asks her a question. And it's a question about her whole destiny. Whence camest thou and whither wilt thou go? That is, after all, her big question. And she answers, I flee from the face of my mistress Sarai. Now, there's in this statement, Tribble says, a reminder that Hagar still thinks of herself as a slave, because she's calling my mistress Sarai. Well, maybe that's what is going on here. She doesn't say where she's going. And the angel of the Lord said to her, return to thy mistress, submit thyself under her hand. This is the moment that justifies the title of Tribble's book. This is a moment of terror. She meets God in the wilderness. She's found water, she meets God, God speaks to her, and then God tells her to go back. And the language here calls attention to the fact that she is going to go back to affliction. God doesn't say, go back, things will be better, I promise you, things will be a little better there. No way. Submit under her hands. What had Sarai been doing with her hands? Abram said to her, thy maid is in thy hand. What do you think Sarah had been doing with those hands? Probably some form of physical abuse. And Hagar's pregnant. So this is a terrifying moment in a way. But the angel goes on and gives promises that seem to make up for the past history of Hagar's affliction and her present continuation of it. I will multiply thy seed exceedingly, for it shall not be numbered for a multitude. Covenant language. And notice it's addressed directly to her. She, her seed will be multiplied. Rarely in the Bible is a woman's seed mentioned. Women don't have seed. Men have seed. Women have wombs. They have furrows or whatever. But Eve's seed is mentioned earlier in Genesis. And here Hagar has seed for some reason. And then the angel says, behold, thou art with child, and thou shalt bear a son and call his name Ishmael, because the Lord hath heard thy affliction. It's a very key phrase. God has heard her and will give her a son and will give her these many descendants. And when he says, thou shalt bear a son, shalt call his name Ishmael, even in the RSV translation, what does that sound like, that language? It's not exactly covenant language, but what language is it? Behold, thou shalt bear a son. Come on. Where's that? All right, this is annunciation language. This is an annunciation scene. Unlike other annunciation scenes in the Bible, though, this is addressed to an Egyptian woman who's going to have a child, who's going to begin a new race. It's not the Jews anymore. It's a combination race that she's going to be the mother of here. And then it goes on. Yeah,
I was Kathy. Thinking that earlier, that sense of terror when Mary was, yeah. I mean, that feeling with Joseph when she was stoned to death. What was going to happen to her? That
seems
to be the
place
of the annunciation part of it.
Yeah. Well, the first terror comes when the angel appears.
Mm-hmm. Where do you get the idea that he's the beginning of a new race? Is that in his text?
Abraham is Jewish or Semitic, whatever. Hagar is Egyptian. I got that idea from, did I say this the other day?
No.
One of my black students who said, oh, that's what this story is about. God is giving permission to the creation, for the creation of a new race. And it's in there.
But when you join Egyptian and a Jew, you're saying you begin a new race. How about if you join a German and a Norwegian? You're not beginning a new race. Mm.
She was pagan, though, correct?
Mm-hmm. According to Jewish legend, yeah. But she talks to the Lord here and names the Lord. So she has this direct confrontation.
So how did she know that?
That's the Lord. Oh. Yeah. The concept of a new race comes later on. That's in 21. I will make of your son a new nation.
Yeah, new nation.
New people. So that's... Yeah.
There are a number of questions here, but let me answer this one. In Jewish legend, they deal with that. I mean, Jewish legend exists partly to reconcile discrepancies in the Bible and explain things that aren't quite clear. And they go into how Sarai raised Hagar, her maid, in the faith of the father. Because Sarai is faithful and she wants, you know, to convert this pagan maid. And then Jewish legend goes on to say, but it didn't take. Hagar goes back to her gods. And in Jewish legend, Hagar is an unregenerate idolater and not even faithful to her own gods, in fact. So Hagar is villainized in Jewish legend, but not here so much. Mm-hmm.
So then Ishmael,
rightly,
inherited his name
that we
met across yesterday.
Yeah, got his name. Uh-huh.
I think there's more in subsequent scripture to bear out that God was making a special act of creation of a new race here, mm-hmm. because we have Ruth, for example, mm-hmm. Being an antecedent to Jesus. Now that did not become a new race. Mm-hmm. That her descendants were woven right into the mm-hmm. Israelite line. So mm-hmm. God really made a special creation of the new race in this particular case.
This story has more of an anthropological implication than the other story about Ruth, although it's significant that there is this foreign blood in the line. I think that's quite extraordinary, and that it comes through a woman as well. Okay. This annunciation scene is a mixed bag. She talks to God and names God, which is, you know, something the Jews did not do. And the name she gives God is, thou God seest me. For she says, have I also here looked after him that seeth me? And she names the well of him that liveth and seeth me. and that there's kind of pun in here, in that God that lives, the God of life, sees her and gives her life. And the person who sees God and lives is her. So there's living and seeing in both directions. And the puns here suggest mutuality, I think, between God and the creature, or between the angel and Hagar. It raises her up to have this sort of exchange with God. This text is somewhat corrupt, and it seems kind of patched together, I think, the way it's written too, even in English. But those puns are there, and the puns on seeing, and it kind of redeems the other seeing earlier in the story, which was, you know, not so terrific. The beholds that were sort of, you know, imperious in the household and so on. So she's given promises. Now, the way Tribble deals with it is basically very skeptically. I mean, she does point out that here is this Egyptian woman who gets the first view and discussion, theological discussion in a way, with God in the Bible. This Egyptian woman, this dark-skinned slave, is the first person in the Bible who is said to see God. That's extraordinary. She's given a special annunciation. Sarah did not get that annunciation. And she has been saved by God in the wilderness. But, on the other hand, Phyllis Tribble, the feminist Old Testament scholar, literary critic, says God is promising a future, but it's a future of conflict. The wild ass of a man, right? And so she says, in Ishmael's story, which is predicted here, in Ishmael's story, Hagar's story continues. This is going to be a future of conflict and a future of physical combat, even, which she's been experiencing on a larger scale. And then she points out that this question Hagar asks says, have I also here looked after him that seeth me? Tribble thinks that's a question, and it's a question in other translations too, because Hagar can't quite believe she saw God. And the reason that Hagar might be somewhat skeptical is that, after all, this God is sending her back to slavery. And here, I want to just bring up something that connects this with our own history. Tribble tends to see this God as an antagonist more than as a friend. And I think we want to consider whether that interpretation is fair or true or not. But she does point out that as soon as Hagar leaves home, there's God finding her. Now, one way you can look at that is, you know, God is sort of a spy for the masters, for the slaveholders. God's got his surveillance cameras out there. God is a policeman for slavery or for patriarchy. And Tribble's focus is on patriarchy, the rule of men, not on slavery. So there's the light's so much better back here. There's in American history, there's a tradition of, and Molefe talked about this in South Africa the other day, there's a tradition of, you know, slave sermons, where you get a preacher up there to give your slaves the word. And what is the word? Obey your masters, etc., etc. Clearly a word only to support the establishment. It's enormous controversy over the baptismal formulas in American slavery, because the baptismal formulas make it clear that, you know, the baptized soul is an equal, is a spiritual equal of the masters. And so there were all these controversies about baptize, what do you baptize slaves, if you do, what do those words really mean? You know, well, in the 1830s, after Nat Turner's rebellion, religion was brought in partly to keep slaves down on the plantation, to keep them in their place, so they don't, you know, do any more of these rebellions. Yeah.
But the characteristics that God predicts for Ishmael are rebellion.
That's true.
Yeah, to me that's a tension there. Mm-hmm. So it isn't a subservient child she's going to have. Mm-hmm. It's, and if I were an oppressed person, other than being a woman, mm-hmm. I would think that that was a gift.
So there is a kind of, there's an interesting tension in the text there, isn't there? Yeah, that's a good point. This is a sermon. This is from a slave narrative published in 1861. I'm just going to read a couple of lines from this. The minister standing up in the pulpit is preaching to the slave. He says, God sees you. You tell lies. God hears you. Instead of being engaged in worshiping him, you are hidden away somewhere, feasting on your master's substance. You know, doing this, doing that. Your masters may not find you out, but God sees you and will punish you. Oh, the depravity of your hearts. You sneak into the back streets or among the bushes to do this or that. God sees you. And it goes on like this. I mean, this is what's happening here. God sees her. God hears her. And sends her back to the plantation. Anyway, Tribble is very skeptical of this God, but primarily because this God is on the side of patriarchy. And she points out that the circle of bondage closes again around Hagar at the end of the story. When Hagar's name is mentioned, but she no longer speaks, she no longer acts, does anything except bear a child. Abraham is the one who calls the son's name, not Hagar, and so on. And Sarah has completely disappeared from the story. And it's sometimes significant when a name disappears. Now I'm going to stop for just a moment and ask you, what is opened up in the text for you by this feminist Old Testament scholar, literary critical interpretation, and what is not opened up? In other words, an interpretation focuses attention, but it also focuses attention away from other things you could do in the text. So what is opened up and what is closed down for you? So especially some of you haven't said anything, you're sitting there, there's little wheels going around in your head, I'm sure. And maybe big wheels. I'd like to know what you're thinking.
Well, definitely puts emphasis on Hagar. And you really don't know what Sarah is feeling or doing or anything else during this time that she's done.
Okay. And a lot of our comments the other day, when we were doing our interpretations orally here, were about Sarah and Abraham, it seemed. Now, Tribble's trying to direct attention to the Hagar's position in this whole story. So it brings out things that you might not have thought about. On the other hand, What's going on with Sarah is what you're wondering. Okay. Anybody else? Is your hand up or you just catching?
Mine was, but I've been talking too much.
Let's hear from you.
Well, you mentioned that Hagar was going to her death, and I was just reading ahead in 21, and it says that his mother got an Egyptian wife for him, mm-hmm. so she must have lived long enough to have him raised.
That's right. Oh, yeah. She doesn't die out there.
Uh-huh.
They go on. Found this new nation. What Tribble said, I've been giving you her interpretation of 21. What she says about that is that's really too bad, because all this means that even though there's promises are given to them, Hagar and Ishmael are outside the covenant. And when she gets him an Egyptian wife, she's sort of sealing his doom. That's her way of looking at it. Now, it might be okay to be outside the covenant, because the covenant, after all, promises blessing to all the nations. So if you're outside were we in the covenant originally? Are we Gentiles? But Tribble assumes that all of the exclusions of Hagar and Ishmael from the covenant are a bad thing. And that is a position that is formed from the viewpoint of the covenant. Right? So she's working within that system. Any other comments?
Well, it seems to me, seems kind of funny that evidently God had told Abram before that he was going to have children.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's up in his 90s, mm-hmm. he's pretty sure he's not going to have any. And then he allows Hagar to have a child with him, And then after the child is born, then he comes back and says, yeah, now you are going to have children. Mm-hmm. And Abraham evidently believes him, partially. I think I would doubt it very seriously. But it would seem funny that God allowed this to happen, that Hagar should have a child.
All right, so there are different, and we suggested some reasons why God might have done that. But it's really very deliberate. It's put in the text. It's a very deliberate plan on God's part.
Yeah.
To have this and to make these people outside the covenant.
Abraham, right?
Go ahead.
Well, one thing I was going to say, what don't you see? And I think one of the things you don't see is I think the purpose of the storyteller, I think the Yahweh in this case, who's putting all of these legends together to show that God is faithful, and that, but there is tension, and it almost is lost because of our own actions. But that God finally resolves this thing, and you can see it over and over again through the patriarchal stories, and even in some of the earlier stories, that the Yahwist weaves an incredible story of tension that is resolved, and tension again that is resolved.
Very much like life.
Yes.
Robert Alter is another person I want to call to your attention. In The Art of Biblical Narrative, R-O-B-E-R-T-A-L-T-E-R. He is a Jew. And all I want to say about him right here is that He treats the Hebrew Bible in terms of the very theme you're talking about, a constant tension between God's will and God's providence and human freedom, which can screw up things, but can also be creative, too. But that tension is there throughout the stories, and here it's certainly evident, too. He has a bit on Hagar and Sarah that I might mention if we get to that. You wanted to say something back there.
Well, it was about what you're just saying, this tension between God's plan and man's free will. Mm-hmm. To me, even though I see this as God creating a separate race through this act, I don't necessarily see it as God's plan originally. To me, the disobedience of, or the distrust that Sarah and Abraham had,
mm-hmm.
was the genesis of this whole thing, and God then did what he did with it, but he allowed them that free will.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that, to me, it necessarily says God caused this to happen.
Mm-hmm.
He allowed it.
Well, and in the Hebrew Bible, there's an idea of partnership between human beings and the Creator, which we've kind of lost that in some of our Lutheran theology, that if people working together with God to, you know, to carry out the covenant, and so partnership takes two to tango.
Yeah, I need some help on what a Samaritan is.
Well,
is that a mix of the two?
Well, that's a whole other story. In fact, that story was told the other day here. And it was by Christine Crossan, wasn't it?
So this isn't the origins of that other race that you're talking about?
Well, the Samaritan race started in the Samaritan racial mixture started in a different way at a much later time.
So it doesn't go all the way back earlier than this one?
No, later. These stories presumably happened around 2000 BC. So it's much later.
Samaritan race is about
1500 years later,
yeah.
Maybe, isn't it?
About after the exile, about 500.
When the Assyrians come into North Israel and carry away the tribes, but a few people are left, and they get mixed up with the people there, and kind of amalgamation takes place. So that's a whole lot later.
Isn't
one more comment.
Somewhere. Okay, my understanding of the Ishmael was like the founder of the group, the Arabs, the people that became...
The Arabs, right, the Bedouin tribes, yeah.
This is where the Quran connects in with...
That's right, because Ishmael becomes a distant descendant by legend of Muhammad. So he becomes very important, and in Muslim tradition, I mean, Hagar and Ishmael are not headed toward homelessness at all. They found a new nation and a new culture. And Mecca. Talk about home. I mean, they are. You know, they're home. I want to share with you some other ideas about these stories, too, from some other points of view, and skip over some of Tribble's other points, which are interesting and really, I think, worth reading about. I mentioned a Jewish feminist, Esther Fuchs. Her basic idea is that the very way the story is told victimizes the women in the story. She kind of steps back and says, these are wife rivalry stories. Why do we have these stories in the Bible? Well, they tend to focus attention on the faults of the women at hand, you know, faithlessness, uppityness, jealousy, etc. And deflect attention away from the patriarchal system in which they live, which has set them up for this rivalry in the first place. Tribble doesn't really deal with it at that level. And Fuchs is kind of assuming that there's life out there, you know, but it's been put into this particular popular story form of the two rival wives, and that helps to make them both, tarnish both of them, and exonerate Abraham throughout the story. And she does a literary analysis of how point by point Abraham comes out smelling like a rose, and the two women just come out looking bad. And she says that type of storytelling divides women when they could be united, whether for, you know, mutual support or rebellion, whatever. That type of story just pits the women against each other by their class positions, and also here, I think, by their race as well, and by their ages. I want to dwell for the last few minutes with you on how a black woman who is a Christian would interpret this story. And there are many things that are different from a Phyllis Tribble type of interpretation. I think each of these opens up some things in the text. Each of these people are responding to their own traditions. Tribble is trying to correct a tradition of interpretation that just didn't pay enough attention to the women, just didn't say very much about the women, and she was bringing out things that hadn't been said before. Esther Fuchs is responding to Jewish legend, she's responding to teachings of the rabbis, and she's also responding to, I think, more modern people like Robert Alter, who discusses the wife rivalry type of scene, but never talks about what it means that we have those scenes. Now, black women are responding out of their own community of interpretation that have just developed in this country since slavery time, when African religions became melded with Christian religion, practices, theology, and developed into a brand new kind of thing. And the people that I might mention here, I've written up Renita Weeding's Just a Sister Away, which is a kind of study guide. In the bookstore, there are about 10 or 15 copies over there. You might want to pick this up. It's very well written. It's very inclusive of non-black perspectives. And Renita Weems is one of the smartest women I know in the academic world. I've read her other stuff, too. She does very highfalutin academic stuff, and then this is a more popular type of book. She's at Vanderbilt. But Just a Sister Away is about this story as seen from a black woman's perspective, but as seen for everyone. So that tells you something right away. Tribble focuses on women and their oppressors, men. This book is more about how various ones of us can become in the oppressor position or the victim position at different times. And men are not the enemy in this account. Well, how would you retell a story from a black perspective? For one thing, there's this appropriation in black tradition, in song, in poetry, in sermons, appropriation of Hagar as a black woman, as an analog for the American slave. And if you think about it, if you know anything about that history, there are all kinds of parallels. And then the slave followed by the domestic as women's work has developed in this country. So that Hagar is seen as a model of black women's experience in America as abused, as afflicted, as sexually abused by masters, as either enduring or running away. You know, both of those possibilities are there. But they also would insist that Hagar is not just a victim of patriarchy or of men or men's systems, that she's also a victim of a class system that sets up a hierarchy, and we have variations on that in our own society, not like the Bible, but still we have our own versions, and also a victim of race. And when a black woman is a victim of racial prejudice, she is a victim of both women and men. So that this is a much more complicated appropriation of the story in which Sarai and Abraham are both oppressor figures, not because Sarai is a Jew, because a womanist perspective, and these black feminists call themselves womanists, would not want to pit one race against another like that. They would say that we, you know, we can all become Sarai's at different times when we are in the privileged position. And so Sarai comes off as problematic, but as a potential sister. And Renita Weems emphasizes the moments in the story when Sarai could have helped and didn't. Not to put Sarai down, but to bring us, you know, to call us to account, to remind us that we might be in that position. And on the book jacket, there's a bit from this quote in the book that gives the book its title. I might read this. At some time in our lives, whether we are black or white, we are all Hagar's daughters. When our backs are up against a wall, when we feel abandoned, abused, betrayed, banished, when we find ourselves in need of another woman's help, a friend, neighbor, colleague, relative, stranger, another man's wife, when we feel that need, we, like Hagar, are in need of a woman who will sister us, not exploit us. In those times, we are frequently just a sister away from our healing. We need a woman, a sister, who will see in our destitution a jagged image of what one day could be her own story. We need a sister who will respond with mercy, not pity, which is random or moody, but mercy that's steadfast, consistent, and free. And so the Hagar position could be, you know, my friend Nancy, whose husband just left her with a child. She's a privileged woman. She has a $3 million business in New York. But she's a Hagar. She's humiliated by her husband leaving her for another woman. And this story is also about those kinds of triangles. Weems lets us think in those directions with the story, whereas sometimes Tribble's interpretation, valuable as it is, and path-breaking though it has been, doesn't always allow us to do that.
But don't you have to kind of pass through some of those, mm-hmm. you know, Tribble,
yeah.
I mean, we have to work our way through the levels of mm-hmm. truth or whatever. I think that's real important to get to,
yeah.
the reconciliation.
Sure. And I think the domestic politics in the story has to be dealt with, and we can relate to that in all kinds of ways, if not personally, then through other people. I mean, we don't just apply the Bible to our personal lives. We might apply it to other people's lives. We might use it to help us see our situation. And in terms of the racism in the story, you know, Weems brings out some of those painful dynamics between white women and black women, and invites us to reflect on those things. And we don't reflect on those things very much. We just don't. It's very painful, or we don't see it. And you know, I work in a context with a lot of Black people in Newark, New Jersey, and at Rutgers. And you know, I hear white people say, "Well, I'm not a racist." Well, it doesn't matter whether you're racist or not. You may be perceived as one, or your actions may be, you know, your actions may have that effect. So what difference does it make in a way what you personally think of it? You know, it's important to know how other people may be applying the Bible to us. So I think that's where other interpretations of the Bible are useful, to expand and enrich and complicate our own applications to ourselves. The application is a much more interesting and complicated thing, and calls us to a kind of faithfulness that is a continual challenge. I have a poem about Hagar, if anybody would like to read it, by a Jewish feminist colleague of mine.